welcome to another episode of Sitting Around Talking Movies. I'm Neil Rose, and we're talking about Ben-Hur today. We're talking about Hands of Stone, the new Robert De Niro movie, which is a biopic on the fighter Roberto Duran. We're going to talk about Bloodfather, the new Mel Gibson movie. We're going to talk about Intervention. We're going to talk about some TV show that everybody seems very excited about called Stranger Things. Strange Things or Stranger Things?
Stranger Things.
I'm joined by Bill McCuddy, as always.
Ta-da.
And I'm joined by Bill Brigoli, as always.
Yeah, you betcha. And
who's that knocking at the door?
Who's that knocking at the door? That's a movie by Martin Scorsese.
I've been looking for you guys all over the place.
Okay.
Oh, look who's here.
Are we doing the podcast or what?
Well, we're doing the podcast.
All right.
We were, and then the shticky opening happened where this guy knocked on the door.
And
we're joined by Jack Rico from showbizcafe.com. Check that out.
Who always brings his own recording studio with him, and he's actually filming us now. We're live on Facebook.
If you want to see what we look like.
We're dead every place else, but we're live on Facebook.
You can go to... How do you do this, Jack? How do you watch this?
Oh, well, this is...
We don't have to tell them they're watching it now.
Okay. Jack Rico on Facebook, and there's a live stream. It's being broadcasted live to everybody, and there's Bill Brigoli. Hey, Bill, thanks a lot for setting everything up.
What about afterwards, if people want to see this after the fact,
This video is then held as archive, so anybody can access it at any other time.
Yeah, it's being held as evidence is what it's being held. It'll all come out in the trial.
All right.
So let's start.
Yeah,
so let's start. So let's start talking about Hands of Stone, which is the new biopic starring Edgar Ramirez as the boxer Roberto Duran. And
Usher,
you know, and Usher plays Sugar Ray Leonard, and Robert De Niro is the his trainer Ray Arcel, who apparently is the greatest trainer to ever be in boxing, who had eight. What are you, Tony Randall?
No.
When Tony Randall, Bill just put on sunglasses. Whenever Tony Randall used to do the Hollywood Squares, they would go, today on the Hollywood Square, you know, one of these stars is sitting in the secret square, and the contestant who picks it first can win a prize package.
You shame me into it.
And Tony Randall was sitting there with sunglasses.
Those of you only listening to this, I just took the sunglasses.
When anybody would go to Tony Randall, he would take the sunglasses off, and then he would put them back on. But anyway, so apparently Ray Arcel was the winningest. He trained more heavyweight and lightweight and middleweight. He has more world title.
He was good.
Yeah.
If only he had trained the scriptwriter.
So,
for this movie.
So anyway, the movie traces Duran's life as a
poor boy,
as a poor boy growing up in Panama, through his rise to the top of the fight game, through those two classic bouts with Sugar Ray Leonard, including the No Mas bout, where he in the second bout he just walks away. In the middle of one of the rounds, he just says, no more, which is no mas, and just walks away.
And by the way, Duran said he never said those words, so right. I don't know why.
Well, you know what they're saying? They're saying that Howard Cosell might have just who was, you know, doing the color commentary on the fight, might have just added that on his
own.
Yeah,
he added a little too much crayon to it.
But regardless of whether he said it or not, he did walk away in the middle of the fight. And I think the movie does a very good job of explaining why that happened. I mean, it was a very famous incident in boxing. And according to the movie, which I believe is true because Roberto Duran served as an advisor on the film, is that, you know, the fight...
That was a good source.
The fight promoters, this makes a lot of sense. You know, after he won the first lightweight belt, title from Sugar Ray Leonard, he was partying and gaining weight and having fun, and he wasn't ready to go back into... That's how he celebrates after he wins a fight. And then, you know, after a couple of months, he gets past that, and it's like, all right, it's time to start training again. But they sign him up to do a fight like 3 months or 4 months after the first...
Well, they being an unscrupulous fight organizer...
Played by Ruben Blades.
Yeah, that sort of shames him into it. And listen, there's too much movie here. There's too many fight scenes. Brigoli's nodding his head.
Too many fight scenes,
too much boxing in a boxing movie. When's that happened before?
Yeah.
I don't think there's too much boxing in a boxing movie.
I didn't like the way the fights were shot. They were shot so tight that I couldn't get any sense of the guys moving around the ring just as they were slugging each other.
There's also every cliche, every hoary cliche in this movie.
Well,
the daughter,
it follows the formula.
The with the drug overdose, the wife who says to De Niro, played, you know, sadly, she's given nothing to do by...
Alan Barkin.
Go with your heart. Go with your heart. Do what your
like
heart says.
How do you like Roberto Duran's wife?
Anna de Armas.
And yeah, you know what? She's also in War Dogs. Yeah. She's the girlfriend in War Dogs.
That's right.
She's the same one. Yeah, in War Dogs.
Right.
whose girlfriend?
Miles Teller's.
Miles Teller's girlfriend.
She looked
in More Dogs.
Yeah. She looked nothing like that.
Well, she had darker hair. That'll throw you right
short
off.
Hair and more. Wow.
Yeah,
that's very interesting. Well, I don't know. Yes, it's very conventional in terms of following formulas, boxing movie formulas. But that said, as I said, I thought it was historically interesting. I know you all hated De Niro's performance. I thought it was really a good performance. I mean, you know, especially, you know, there's this mob guy played by John Turturro who...
For 10 seconds.
They put a hit years ago in backstory on De Niro, and he survives, you know, because he wanted to take boxing to all these different cities, and Turturro says, no, boxing stays in New York. And then De Niro kind of goes as Ray Arcel, defies that order to stay away from boxing, and you know there's kind of like a subservience that De Niro shows towards Turturro, a bit of defiance and a bit of respect, and that's a difficult line to walk, and I think he pulls it off very well. But I know you guys hated the De Niro.
Well, my favorite guy was Usher Ray.
He did a good Sugar Ray.
That's a movie that I would watch a Sugar Ray about him.
This is what I was saying on the show.
This is a after show to Talking Pictures, a show we do on New York One every week and also airs nationally on Time Warner Cable, where we look at movies that are in theaters and we also look at movies that are on demand. And as Bill McCuddy always says...
We watch the bad movies so you don't have to.
We do indeed. And I think this is a good movie, but you guys think it's a bad movie. But well, I'm sorry.
I'm thinking it's an okay movie and too long.
Really?
Yeah, okay is a nice
pass. Here's what
pass.
I was saying. Steven Spielberg took Lincoln... And he just took a slice of Lincoln's life and decided to kind of create a whole movie around it because it was probably the more interesting about the Civil War and the decision going into the Civil War, should I put America in this condition? This is the same thing that the director, who's also Panamanian, I think he should have just taken the Sugar Ray Leonard fights, building up to that drama that we all know very well, but he should have given us sort of layers of behind the scenes of what happened pre, post, after. We didn't necessarily get that. We got that as a part of the middle.
Kid, he's running around the streets.
Yeah, it's a full biopic.
Filling mangoes in Panama to feed his siblings.
Also, as we said on the show, Bergoglio, did you notice that De Niro was actually like sort of reading his lines off cue cards in some of the scenes? He's looking at somebody, an actor, and then he looks to the right and starts talking to them. And there's a scene at the wall where they're not allowed to get there. A military cop comes over and says, "Don't sit down there." He starts to give this guy a lecture, and he keeps looking over like.
See, I thought it was De Niro's best performance as of late.
How is that possible?
Yeah. Because okay, as I told you, first of all, not only was it that fine line of all those elements that he brought together, but also, I mean, even in the gesture of combing Roberto Duran's hair in between. He goes, "Why do you keep combing my hair?"
But that's
in
the script. That's a nice business from the script.
But he was evoking not only great advisory capacity, you know, from a strategic gesture, but from a strategic point of view, but also there was this paternal thing that I saw going on where he kind of like felt like it was like I thought it was a very expressive, very good performance. And I believe me, I'm no fan of De Niro's performances lately. Films are awful.
I wanted to know where the kitchen sink was, because everything is in this film but the kitchen sink. You can check every cliche box off.
And I have sound bites.
Listen.
As much as I didn't like it, you talked to some of the stars.
Let's hear about it, Bill Bergoglio.
Well, first of all, Robert De Niro talked about his character and how Ray Arcel was sort of a different kind of fight trainer.
He was more like a banker, and some people said that. He was elegant, and he just had a reserve about him that was very interesting, and he was special, and had like 20 or over 20 champions.
And then I've got Edgar Ramirez talking about how much Roberto Duran means to Panama.
I mean, he became the identity of Panama, and when he fought Sugar Ray Leonard in the first fight and won over Sugar Ray Leonard, then it was more than just a boxing fight. It was way more than that. In a way, it was a settlement of accounts for many Panamanians.
Well, according to this movie, he meant a lot to Panama, because when he walked off in the middle of the fight, he was like, everybody hated him. But listen, I don't think it's a great movie. Don't get me wrong, but I think it's historically interesting. From a formulaic boxing movie, I thought it was a good movie. I mean, there's a lot of formulaic boxing movies. They all follow a certain formula. I mean, from Rocky to Raging Bull doesn't follow the formula, but you know how many dozens of boxing movies? I mean, we were talking about this on the TV show today and how they launched careers from Kirk Douglas and Champion and John Garfield and Body and Soul
and
William Holden and Golden Boy.
Right.
And on and on and on. I mean, they just...
Like Michael Lerner says in Barton Fink to Barton, he goes, it's Wallace Beery, it's a wrestling picture. It writes itself.
Right. And Paul Newman got launched in Somebody Up There Likes Me. They're all the same formula. You know, it's like...
If you're going to do the same thing, you got to do it better. And I don't think this movie does it better. And true doesn't always make a good movie. True is just an excuse to make it the way it happened instead of making it a good film.
Well, I think...
What do you got to say about that, Neil?
Well, I think it explained why he walked out of the fight, and I thought the story was kind of interesting. Yeah, was it hokey, the scenes with the wife? Was it right out of, like, you know, 100 other movies where the wife, you know, all of a sudden he starts fooling around, and the wife is like, I'm leaving you. I mean, yeah, it's a formula thing.
Not a likable guy, by the way.
No. He had a bad temper in real life.
He had a bad temper. He walked out or asked De Niro to stop training him a couple of times, and De Niro's like Pacino in Godfather 3. You know, they keep sucking me back in. He goes back in, all except the, well,
I gotta,
don't
you know,
give too much away, but
here's the thing. This is an interesting look at Roberto Duran's life. He meant a lot to Panama, to any Latino boxing fan. This is what we were rooting for, but there's a better, there's a documentary called 30-30 that ESPN did called No Mas. That is the ultimate engaging, compelling story on the Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, and what he meant not only to Panama, but what he meant to boxing. He's considered one of the best pound-for-pound boxers in the history of the sport. And when Sugar Ray Leonard talks about his fight, he says that he was this close to death. He knows what death felt like because that's what Ali had told him when he fought Joe Frazier. So
where was that scene in the movie?
This is what I'm saying. The documentary 30 for 30 that ESPN did on No Mas between Duran and Leonard is much more compelling than what this movie is.
Yeah.
So would you recommend it, Bill Bregoli?
Only if you're a boxing fan.
You do not recommend it, Jack.
I do not recommend this at all.
You do not recommend it. And I say
watch this
that 30, I would
recommend thing because it sounds like they remembered their lines.
I would recommend it for the historical significance and for the acting. And I think this Duran story deserves to be told. And maybe they took a little license with it, but I enjoyed it. And is it a great movie? No. Is it a decent movie? Yeah, it's fun.
Neil, like what's the best boxing movie you've ever seen?
I gotta go with Raging Bull. I mean, which is not like I'm not really going out there on a limb. You know, that's probably the best boxing movie. There's a lot of great boxing movies here. I wrote some down. And
Bill, what do you think is your favorite?
Raging Bull was my number one movie of all time for a long time. It sort of flips back and forth between a couple of others that aren't boxing films. I really like Ali. And to your point earlier about how if this film had just dealt with one little incident, you know, the Ali movie deals. Michael Mann does a good job of telling the whole Muhammad Ali's story.
I'm not a big fan of that
But he
film.
Hones in on the Zaire, the rumble in the jungle, the way this movie doesn't. The No Mas fight in this movie is just like every other fight in the movie. Mm-hmm. It doesn't build to that in any way that's interesting to me. It's just in the middle of one of the fights, he stops fighting and walks away.
Right. Bregoli, what's your favorite boxing film of all time?
I'm going with Raging Bull. And by the way, Kathy Moriarty from that film was my first celebrity kiss on the lips.
Wow!
Wow. The lead?
Wow.
Man, how did that happen?
Yeah, do tell.
We got friendly interviewing each other. It was like the third or fourth time. And at one point she says to me, I ought to fix you up with my sister. On second thought, I ought to fix you up with me.
Wow.
And she kisses me on the lips.
How old was she?
This was about 14, 15 years ago. It was a while ago. She was still working. It was after Casper.
Wow. What do you think is the most underrated boxing film or the one that you just don't hear about that's a really good film?
The Hurricane, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And that's great. Yeah. Denzel Washington's great.
He got robbed. Kevin Spacey won American Beauty that year, which, you know, all credit for Kevin. But this was a full-out rob. Denzel Washington gave
that.
One of the better performances he's done in a long time up to that point.
He thought he was
going to
get it, too. I remember that.
And I think everybody thought he was going to get it. And the fact that he didn't was very shameful, especially because of the topic. This was a movie about a man who was innocently convicted and unfortunately came out too late, and there was a book written and everything. It's a great story, great fighting scenes, great performances. Underrated.
I think another underrated one is Cinderella Man, because I didn't know that story.
But everybody knows that movie's great.
Yeah, I don't know.
So it's not like underrated.
It didn't make a ton of money at the box office.
But it was greatly acclaimed.
Not necessarily underrated, but nobody knows the film anymore because it was like from like 70 years ago. It's a movie called City for
Conquest. So you were at the opening?
Wait, what's the name of the movie?
City for Conquest with James Cagney. Really good film. James Cagney's a boxer. He goes in the ring, and some guy, the boxer that he's fighting, puts some kind of like acidy stuff on his
knuckles,
on his boxing gloves, which blinds James Cagney. It's really a good film. Nobody heard it. I saw it like on $1 million movie or something when I was a kid on television, and it's great. It's a great boxing.
Did anybody see The Greatest? The one where actually Muhammad Ali plays himself in a
long,
movie?
Yeah, long time ago. And isn't Veronica Porsche also in that?
Yeah. Yeah. What did you guys think of Ali's performance?
I don't remember.
He plays himself.
Yeah, I remember being underwhelmed. I remember
I didn't see it. What
I was
did you
disappointed.
Think?
Well, you know, it's Ali acting. Yeah. So it was very laughable.
He was very
sort of
unconvincing as himself.
Yes, he was.
I also love the first Rocky film. It won the Academy Award for Best Picture of the Year. It's a great film. I mean, you know, you look at Rocky now.
It's the template for every other boxing movie.
Yeah, and it's also all those six or seven Rocky sequels that they made.
The setup was fantastic.
But that first Rocky movie, before there were all those other Rocky movies, I mean, Sylvester Stallone was like charming when he's like rents the ice skating rink and just, you know, is like walking around with Adrian on the rink and the whole thing about, you know, Burgess Meredith going, you know, like, you got talent, you're wasting it, you're a bum, get in that ring and train and you can do it.
And then in Creed, he becomes Burgess Meredith.
That's correct. Right. He's cop to that.
Full circle.
Historians say that the setup by Robert Weiss directed is considered the greatest boxing film of all time.
John Avildsen directed the first Rocky movie.
No. He's talking about the setup. The 1950s
film. The setup. I'm sorry. The setup of the first Rocky film. The actual movie, the setup.
The setup.
All right, let's move on. Although, I'll close out with one more boxing question that I'll throw out. What do you think boxing films are the most... What do you think the enduring appeal of boxing films? They've been going on since the silent era with The Champ, you know, and they keep making them. And do you think they're the most successful of all the sports films, John? You know, like more than...
Well, we'd have to look that up. That's a dopey question.
I think there's more boxing films
you
than
baseball
films or football
films. You can Google most profitable
films.
Sports movies.
I didn't say profitable. I think there's more of them than there are.
So as a genre,
as a genre.
Right.
Yeah, and what do you think accounts for their enduring popularity?
If I may, I think it's the story of the 99%. This is the blue-collar nobody...
Exactly.
Defying their detractors to become somebody. And it's the story of the rags to riches, the underdog story. And that's the thing that ultimately connects with all audiences, because we, the 99%, we kind of all live that. So we put ourselves on the backs of these characters for them to rise to the top and defy everything.
Right. These boxers do not usually, or none that I know, come from, you know, any
aristocratic,
kind of, any kind of life of privilege. And they have to fight their way literally to the top. And then when you get to like these characters, which is the formula, you get to like root for them. Then you don't just see them like on a baseball a mound, you know, trying to hit a ball. You see them not only rooting for them, it's the ultimate rooting. Kill this other guy, beat this other guy, knock him out, and you get very involved in it. And I think that formula really works.
You seem very taken with it right now. You look like you could go in the ring right now.
Me? I get knocked out in 10 seconds.
Hey, listen, don't punch Bill Bergoglio. You know, he has a pretty face, man.
By the way, if you ever find yourself in a cocktail party with David Mamet and you want to talk about something...
You could curse your way through it.
Boxing?
Jewish boxers.
Really?
Oh, yeah. How many of them are there?
There are a few. There was one in Boston that both he and I saw fight, and we were talking about him during a press conference once.
Is that what Red Belt is about? Red Belt's a boxing movie that he wrote, right?
No, isn't it like a karate movie?
No, I think he...
Red Belt?
I think there's...
So look at you, Bill Bergoglio, kissing Kathy Moriarty, hanging out with David Mamet, and finding the sweet spot in conversation.
What other stories you got deep in the...
Unbelievable.
You're a trove.
Unbelievable.
I'm just going to... Parcel them out.
All right. So, and speaking of Bill Bergoglio, none of us saw Ben-Hur, the remake of Ben-Hur.
Oh, God.
But Bill Bergoglio did.
Oh, Ben Hurts.
So
Paramount screening room.
Nice, that's the headline.
In 3D.
Ben Hurts.
In 3D, we had to put the glasses on, and And not the usual suspects as far as press showing up. There are a lot of people who brought like 10 or 15 little kids who were kind of ordinary.
Well, if they'd gone to the theater, it might have made more money. It was a total bomb, $11 million last weekend.
It's just a big, sort of a, like a made-for-TV movie almost. It would have done actually better maybe if they
How much did it cost to make?
$100 million.
TV producer.
Cost $100 million?
$100 million.
Do you think it'll do well internationally?
No.
No. This is they're calling this a full-scale debacle.
The chariot scene is exactly as long as the one in the 1959 version. However, the way they edit it is almost like an MTV movie. You can tell everything was shot for like a 3 or 4 second take, and then they said, okay, stop, now we move on to the next stunt.
And there's
and then they edit it all together. And there's
a ton of CGI.
Yeah, the racetrack itself, they only built a third of it. I got press notes. They only built a third of it, and at Cinecittà, which is the same place where they shot the original.
Cinecittà Studios in Rome.
And
now at this screening,
Jack Huston is a rather underwhelming Ben-Hur.
Well, there was articles that talked about how this is the perfect case study of why you still need movie stars, because if they had a. It escapes my mind that the gentleman who, Charlton Heston, if it had a Charlton Heston, maybe the movie probably would have worked out better. It would have been more appealing, would have attracted more audiences, but it had nobody. And the Ben-Hur sort of concept doesn't relate to anybody today.
Well, it did have Morgan Freeman. But every time he shows up, you go, look, it's Morgan Freeman.
In dreadlocks.
It's really weird. And the way he acts, he doesn't put on
like
an accent or anything.
Battlefield
Earth. He's just being Morgan Freeman.
There's a scene in the original Ben-Hur that I remember quite well where Ben-Hur is a slave on a ship.
Yeah,
and
in the galley.
Ramming
That's
speed.
That's actually the best part of this
ramming
movie.
Speed. And there were all the. This actually was a Trivial Pursuit question. I remember once it was like, how many different speeds?
You play Trivial Pursuit?
Well, no, I say years ago. I remember this question: how many different speeds were there? And I'm going, okay, there was ramming speed, there was this speed. So they do that scene.
They actually do that pretty well.
So that's probably the best part of the film.
And then he's out alone, and he meets the other guy.
He runs into Morgan. He's eventually a slave, and then the galley ship crashes.
Well, he saves the guy in the galley. That's how he becomes
And also, he's a horse whisperer. He's a horse whisperer in this, and that's why he gets to do the
Ben-Hur
chariot.
Ben-Hur's a horse whisperer.
He's a horse whisperer.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. He's has-been. The movie is has-been. But here's the thing. They think that because Mark Burnett and his wife, Roma Downey, executive produced it, and they know how to produce Christian-based or religion-based movies.
Faith-based.
That it's maybe going to make some money in churches and have an afterlife out there.
If they only made $11 million, and Jack, you're saying that it's not going to do well internationally, that's got to be a lot of churches and a lot of praying back there.
What a lot of praying.
That was Paramount?
That was Paramount.
Paramount
so
Pictures.
So they're going to take a bloodbath on that one.
That's right. And they're already dealing with Tom Cruise because he's holding up production of Mission Impossible 6 because it wants a bigger piece of the back end. And Paramount's going to go, I'll give you a back end.
Oh! Bill Brigoli.
Thank you, Kanye West.
So, Ben-Hur, will that be out of the theaters in a couple of weeks, you think?
Yeah, sure.
Next week.
It'll be out of the top 10 this week.
Yeah. Wow, that's the bomb of the summer. Is that maybe a bigger bomb than Suicide Squad? Then what's the guy from the guy who played Tim Riggins on Friday Night Lights and he got the movie and?
The
Lone Ranger?
No.
This year.
It wasn't this year. It was.
John Carter.
John Carter. Yes, it's going to be as big a bomb as John Carter or the Lone Ranger.
Oh, Tomorrowland. Lone Ranger was pretty bad.
I don't know. In terms of financial disasters.
Suicide Squad was good. Go see it.
You liked it.
He just said.
Oh, yeah, Jack, you're a comic book guy. We've had this whole discussion.
I did not see the film.
Okay.
I was on vacation in Europe.
So Mel Gibson.
If you're watching this live on Facebook, edit that part out.
Okay,
thank you.
So Mel Gibson is back in a movie. It's kind of a B-movie called Bloodfather. And Mel Gibson plays this ex-con who's now living in a trailer. And he gives his job as he's a tattoo artist. And he goes to AA meetings. He's an ex-alcoholic, and William H. Macy is his sponsor. And his daughter is a complete screw-up. The movie opens with the story of the daughter. Would somebody tell
She's Erin Moriarty, who was great or pretty good in Captain Fantastic. She's on the run from a drug gang because she's involved in a shooting of Diego Luna, short for lunatic, in this particular role. And she wants his help, but she's in a different movie. I have to tell you, you like this movie, I think, more than I did.
I thought that Aaron Moriarty, I thought that Mel Gibson was at least committed to doing the performance, but I thought he chewed the scenery. But Aaron Moriarty as the daughter gave such a horrendous performance that it took me out of the movie.
Yeah, I agree.
And every time she opened her mouth, I was aware of the fact that she was acting. It wasn't just like a poor performance, it was an abysmal performance. Wow. What did you think, Jack?
I think outside of the acting, outside of the bad acting of Moriarty, I was really compelled by Mel Gibson's performance. I still think the guy has it. I've always thought he's been a fantastic actor. It's just that everything off screen has affected our perception.
I didn't think
and
that
has
was
degraded
that great of a performance. It was okay. It's like a B movie.
But
look,
he's command
on. The daughter gets caught up with drug dealers who want her dead, and Mel Gibson's protecting her. They're estranged, and she contacts him, and it's a kind of like we've seen that formula in a thousand movies.
But Jack's right. I mean, Mel Gibson is a really hard guy to like. You bring a lot of baggage to his movies.
I like him in Braveheart.
Well, I mean, he brings a lot of baggage to the movie theater. And you have to get over what you think of him. The way they said Woody Allen wasn't going to be able to be in movies anymore. I think Mel Gibson is going to be able to be in movies. And they're going to be like this. They're going to be small. But he's got to have better writers. And he's got to have better direction.
Yeah, he didn't direct this one, right?
No, it was a French guy, the guy who did Les Miserines, or Miserine.
Well, do you think he's a box office deterrent, or do you think he's going to draw people into watching this particular thing, you know?
I think internationally he's still a draw, but I think he's one of those guys around here who's kind of box office poison.
Yeah.
Well, our friend Robert Wall, who's done this show, told me that he's got a movie coming out that he just directed called Hacksaw Ridge that Mel Gibson
directed. Oh, that looks amazing.
That Robert Wall told me, we were on the phone last night, and he told me this previously, that it's apparently an amazing film. And he's not in Hacksaw Ridge, but he directed this film, and it's supposedly quite something.
Well, have you heard what the premise is about?
Of Hacksaw Ridge? Tell us.
So I saw the trailer the other day, and I was just completely astounded. Where was this film? So basically,
it's the first conscientious objector and serving during World War II.
It's about a young kid who does not want to go to war and kill people, and he makes the whole movie is about him not wanting to go to war with a gun and fight. And refuses to carry a weapon.
Right.
And he's like a doctor. So the idea is for him to help people when they are shot and bleeding, et cetera, et cetera. But there's this whole dramatic arc of the whole movie of him defying the army and the military during World War II.
He's the first conscientious objector in American history to receive the Medal of Honor. Now, is that just...
Spoiler alert. No, we
know. Trump? You going to tell me Trump's getting his Purple Heart?
No, spoiler alert, I said.
Oh. No. That's the description of the film. I'll read just right off IMDb. All right, so anyway, back to Mel Gibson. So I thought this movie was... it's watchable. You know, if you like Mel Gibson, you know, and you don't take any of that baggage, I mean, it's worth a cheap on-demand rental, I think, you know, but it's not great. I mean, would you rent it?
No, I would not rent it.
I'm not recommending it.
Yeah, I barely recommend it. Yeah, I don't know. No, she's... You know what? If they got a better actress to play the daughter other than Aaron Moriarty...
Script is still lousy, and that shootout at the end is ridiculous.
She's just horrible.
Just ridiculous.
She's just horrible.
Won't be an Oscar consideration.
Shoot it at the end, talk about spoiler alert. When I saw everything coming in this movie a mile away, I won't give away what happens at the end, but I just saw everything was like, okay, this is going to happen now, that's going to happen now, you know? Anyway, there's another movie up there, which is a very different kind of movie called Intervention, which borrows heavily from The Big Chill, and The Big Chill borrowed heavily from The Return of the Secaucus 7.
I said on the air, I think they shot it in the same house as The Big Chill. They didn't. Yeah. That was in Beaufort, South Carolina.
This is in Savannah,
Georgia, just outside of that. But
I like the intervention.
Country.
Right, so let me tell you what it's about. Four couples go away to a weekend retreat somewhere in the country.
Savannah, Georgia.
Yes, as you just said. And they orchestrate an intervention on another couple whose marriage is on the rocks, and they actually want the couple to get divorced. Talk about a wacky premise here.
So a marriage intervention.
Yeah, marriage intervention. And you know, other than that premise, which is unusual, it's very familiar. You know, we've gone down this road with the couple spending a weekend and little hanky-panky goes on and, you know, and
we're not going to stop 20-somethings. We're not going to stop 20-somethings from making movies, Neil. It's just going to keep happening. Well, this is a very familiar territory to a lot of young filmmakers.
Is.
And I've happened to find this one sort of entertaining. I mean, I thought it was interesting. There is a twist at the end. You said on the show that you didn't think there was a twist, which I don't know if we're even talking about the same thing.
What twist?
But there's
there
not.
There is no twist.
Yeah, there's
twist.
They don't. One couple that you expect to be.
I saw that.
No,
coming
that
also.
Was coming since the beginning, the middle of the film.
Well, I like Melanie. How do you pronounce it?
Melanie Linsky.
Linsky. She's like this alcoholic who's orchestrating.
She's funny.
Horrible character, but
she's
great.
She's
great.
She steals the movie.
And I like Vincent Piazza. Who you
we
might
saw him in Boardwalk
from,
Empire. He played
Al Capone.
Yeah,
he's also from Jersey Boys. I mean, he's very good as one of
he's
the.
He's like a young Dylan McDermott or young. He looks like
and
some other actor.
He's married to he's the cup part one half of the couple that they want to
Colby
get divorced
Smulders.
To Colby Smulders. And I thought, and I always like watching Colby Smulders. And you know,
this
that
time
was,
she has a broken leg, so she can't get away from you.
Now, do you think that was written into the script, or do you think that she just happened to have that and they wrote around that? What do you think?
I don't know. We'd have to look that up.
What do you think?
She has a broken. I think they wanted somebody to have something interesting, so somebody had a broken leg.
I don't know. You know, I'm mixed on this one too. I mean, it's serviceable.
It.
It's watchable. Nothing more than that. I mean, I'd say rent Return of the Secaucus 7.
Here's what I think about
chill.
The intervention. I think
and
if
plus,
you...
what's his name? Jason Ritter's in it. Uh-huh. And he was in another movie just like this where
I'm telling you, these people are all making the same movies, Neil. You just have to decide whether you want
Here's
to see
the thing.
Them or not.
The intervention to me was, if anybody's ever been married, you know what it's like to have the some of those like daily fights with your wife. And this movie really sort of highlighted those aspects of... Not every marriage is perfect. And so at some point, you're trapped in a marriage because you don't have the gall to break up with the woman that you just said to everybody is...
The balls. You don't have the balls.
Well, okay, the balls, with a Z, to leave the marriage. And so what this movie is saying is sometimes you need help to realize what's in front of you, that this marriage is a failure. And it touched some very raw moments. I mean, that movie had some raw moments with Colby Smulders saying, everybody, F you, get out of the house.
Right.
I felt okay, those.
Well, here's the thing, Jack. I think that it's so unreal. I mean, aside from seeing this in so many other movies, as Bill McCuddy just said, you know, like they just keep making the same movie over and over again. The whole fundamental premise about a bunch of couples getting together to have an intervention to suggest that another couple gets divorced is such a lunatic premise unto
itself. It's original.
Itself,
it's original.
You know, that I couldn't buy into that.
How often have you heard that premise anywhere?
No, I never heard that
you
premise.
You can't call it trite. You can't
stupid.
Call it cliche.
Who would do something like that?
Millennials do everything in a gang. They don't do anything individually.
That's true.
Watch all these movies.
It's all group.
They make a group
ensembles.
Decision to go to a bar. They all decide who's going to sleep with who.
And all these characters
who.
Are
they do everything
these
in committee.
Very good.
You think so?
Give it a shot, Neil. Give
well,
it a
no,
shot.
I've seen the film. I mean, I
you don't like it.
I said it's serviceable, I'm repeating myself, and watchable, nothing more. If you like this kind of thing, yeah, sure, why not? But I wasn't bored with it. I mean, I wasn't like
you had
the
to turn
Sea
it
of Trees, which we'll talk about
oh,
right
we
now.
We have to talk about this movie.
You
know,
we can just say
I was not,
it.
It was short, it was 80 some odd minutes, or 90 minutes, you know, with the intervention. I was like, yeah, other than the unoriginality part and the far-fetched aspect, the characters, I like the acting, I like the performances, some of the dialogue was okay. Yeah, if you like that kind of thing, sure, I'll just barely give it a pass. All right, Sea of Trees, Jack, take it away.
This is a movie that I particularly thought had Oscar contender written all over it for Best Picture.
Before you saw it.
Before I saw it, yeah, of course, you know, that's what I was
it's
thinking.
It's got Oscar Mayer.
No, that's another movie called Sausage Party. But
Sausage Fest.
Sausage Party. So there's this movie.
All right, what do I know?
So how did I not think that this movie was going to be great? You look at the trailer. It's directed by Gus Van Sant. It's starring Naomi Watts, Matthew McConaughey, Japanese actor Ken Watanabe. Everything about this film, it's metaphorical.
Ken Watanabe.
It looks important.
It looks important.
It looks important.
It has the look of an important prestige film.
You think this is
going to
be like, yes, it looks like it's going to be one of these Oscar contenders.
The story is about two men that are suicidal. They're trying to take their lives in this mysterious forest in Mount Fuji. And
it's called Suicide Forest.
It's called
nicknamed Suicide Forest.
And with warnings, with all kinds of warnings saying, please don't take your life.
Now, right. And so this is not adapted from any book. This is an original story. The script by this guy named Chris Sparling or something like that.
Yeah, it stinks.
Was on a blacklist of a film of the best scripts that have never been made.
Jesus. That's unbelievable to me.
And that is so unbelievable.
And so what happens with the film is that ultimately it's too confusing, too clouded by its philosophy. It's too meta for you to truly understand and grasp what the movie's trying to say. In the process, Matthew McConaughey provides one of the worst performances that I've seen him do in the last 5 years since he won Dallas Buyers Club in the Oscar.
Worse than the Lincoln commercials?
Yes, he was in, and he's slowly becoming a parody of himself. And what I noticed was very antiseptic, very sterile performance.
What do you think's worse, the Lincoln commercial performances, although they're only like 20, 30 seconds, or this entire performance? Let's get away from length. Like, what's just more pretentious to listen to?
Matthew McConaughey
and the Lincoln commercial going, like, talking to his two dogs in the back seat.
You're not getting sushi this week.
Right, I mean, or this.
I don't take a left, I go, all right, all right, all right. I'm waiting for that Lincoln commercial. He doesn't. I go right on red.
I drove a Lincoln before anybody made me drive a Lincoln. Yeah, I'd say that's worse. Oh, yeah.
I think he probably drove a Lincoln as an Uber driver before anybody else drove a Lincoln, or anyone told him to do it in an earlier.
Yeah. This is just a terrible movie. I mean,
terrible.
It's just terrible.
It thinks it's good. That's the problem. It thinks it's going to be a contender.
Too clever,
and it's not.
Yeah, it's
I think
not.
It's self-indulgent. I think it's scattered, it's all involving, and ultimately it becomes absurd.
And it's depressing and grim and gloomy. It's agonizing.
Did you see that? Did you see the ending coming at all?
No, not at all. I feel like it had three endings. It would never end, that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a Peter Jackson.
Kind of like this podcast.
It's like Lord of the Rings. It just does.
So we all hate that. Nobody wants to see it. So
Bill Bregoli is the lucky one here.
Because he never got to see it.
You kissed Naomi Watts?
Have I kissed? No. Okay. But I notice I have a
now
thing.
You said, Bill Bregoli, that this was your first celebrity kiss on the mouth was Kathy Moriarty, which says to me,
There were others,
yes. So what were the other kisses?
There was another one who pinched my ass once.
Whoa!
Really? Male or female?
Female.
Okay, good.
Wow.
First name Amber.
Heard?
Oh.
Tamblyn.
Wow.
Yeah, I was in California.
Did you ever have Neil? You really dragged it out there.
Well, Betty White and I had a passionate affair for many, many decades. And I can't talk about it because it's... No, I'm kidding.
Here's what we should talk about before we go.
Next week, we're all four
members of the BFCA, the Broadcast Film Critics Association.
That's correct.
And as you know, the end of the year is all about the awards season. And the Golden Globes has been the first one out of the gate after a couple of local, like Boston and New York.
Always
the National Board of Review, but I'm talking about a television show. So the first, like, the bellwether,
yes,
everybody that
Golden
the public,
Globes.
That most of the people watching this or listening to this would think of the Golden Globes. So the Broadcast Film Critics is made up of a more credible group. The Hollywood Foreign Press is 80 or 90 people, some of whom work at Circuit City and write for some German.
I have a newsletter in Panama that's read by 23 people.
Right.
I'm a member of the Hollywood
Foreign get their
Press.
Pictures taken with the celebrities.
We have about 300 people, and I full disclosure, we are all members of the Broadcast Film
Critics
Association.
Yeah, and it's a credible organization.
Yes, despite our membership, it is. So it's moved its
moved it up to December 11th. The BFCA is going to be the first award show out of the gate, and it'll be on TV like last year. It's on VH1?
The great T.J. Miller.
No, I think it's on A&E.
And they combine television and
movies
like the Golden Globes. The BTCA. And the BFCA. So you'll have all the TV people and all the... Right, so what's going to happen here is the BFCA will have more of an influence on... because, you know, on the what's going to get nominated for Academy Awards. So if there's some little film that nobody really, you know, was championing and it wins or gets nominated for... I mean, because the Oscar voters look at all the prior awards in these award seasons.
It means we wield incredible power now for the first time ever.
Yeah, but what's going to happen?
We see these movies really early.
What's going to happen is
we better get our screeners.
Yeah, that's the problem. We're not.
The problem is the same problem that the National Board of Review runs against. Is like we used to have the awards in the middle of January, early January, so all the movies were out already, and we got all the screeners. But now because it's
And we got
December,
them twice.
Right.
Once we nominated, then we got it right. sent again.
So we got December 11th, which means that the nominations are going to probably be like early December, which means that a lot of these films aren't going to be released yet, and
well,
they're going to invite us to screenings, and we're not going to get those screeners. And once those awards are over, you're not going to get any screeners because there's no vested interest for them to send you the screeners. So if you like to get screeners...
Uh-oh, here's Joey Berlin now calling.
Okay.
All right, I have a... Can we do something really quick?
Sure.
Since I know that we don't have that much time, let's speculate right now. In your mind, Bill, front runner for Best Picture since it's almost coming up so far.
I hear great things. I haven't seen anything that I would call a front runner. I mean, I think Meryl Streep is probably going to be nominated
for
Florence Foster Jenkins.
Sure.
Manchester by the Sea, I hear great things about.
Neil?
Well, nobody loved War Dogs. I love that film. I would have said, but it's gotten such mixed reviews that I don't think that it will get Oscar consideration. But I did really, that's one of my favorite
films.
Well,
Jonah Hill will get a Golden Globe nomination.
All right,
that's one of my favorite films this year is War Dogs.
I'm
so
going
far.
With Birth of a Nation as the front runner, even though Nate Parker's now involved in this rape issue. But nevertheless, I think the
you
film.
Saw it?
But. Oh, no, we're just speculating on what we think is going to be the front runner.
You want to know what's going to get a You know who's going to get a nomination? Write it down. Sally Field for Hello, My Name Is Doris.
Ah,
watch and see.
All right,
they like
watch
her.
And see.
Sally Field
because they like her.
Because they really like her. They really like her.
They don't really like her that much.
Zootopia.
Zootopia. Zubo and the Two Strings.
I don't know. Well, what do you think, Jack, other than Birth of a Nation?
Well, I think that's the movie that is,
Sully, Tom Hanks.
Is for the times. Mm-hmm. I think that's the movie that's needed right now
to
in Hollywood.
Oscar's so white, you mean to counteract that?
Not only that, but just in society. We're living some very conflicted times. And
but
I think
that doesn't make it a good movie.
No,
and that doesn't mean
it
that
movie,
it's supposed
to. But it's
to.
Timely. That's what I'm saying. It's timely.
Well, you know,
it speaks to
political.
The era that we're
that's
living in.
That's why it sold for $17 million
right.
at Sundance, the most that's ever been paid
the most.
For anything.
Netflix
it was a knee-jerk reaction, and we'll see whether it can
right.
deliver.
And then I think for television, I think the O.J. Simpson is going to win Best TV Show.
That's possible.
I love the O.J. Simpson thing.
That was
great.
Fantastic movie.
That was great. So next week on the show, Jerry Lewis movie, Max Rose.
Okay, and scene.
Wow. Today,
when we come back in 2 weeks, we will not have a podcast in 2 weeks. We're going to talk about the new Jerry Lewis movie, Max Rose.
And
we're going to talk about Sully. Tom Hanks movie. And we're going to talk about a whole bunch of stuff. So enjoy your Labor Day weekend, and we'll sit around for Jack Rico, showbizcafe.com, Bill McCuddy, Bill Bergoli, me, Neil Rosen. Enjoy Labor Day weekend. We'll see you 2 weeks. And thanks for sitting around talking movies with us. We'll sit around talking movies with you next time.